Confession number 12241, Mr. Bill Laverick, Reel 14.
Mr. Laverick, Reel 14. You'd gone back to Harton after being out at Hyde.
That's right.
Firing at V1.
Yes.
Were you there long this time?
We weren't there too long, no. I don't know. Actually, I don't know why we'd sent up there. Whether it was considered to be a rest camp or something like this, you know, where you're sent for a rest or anything. It could have been anything. But we were sent up to a place that we were never in any action. There was never any action at the time we were there. And all you'd done was your gun drills and such like, you see, on the site. It was a rest, really. You slept, you got your sleep at nights and everything.
Now, the war was moving on. Were you getting any interest in politics coming back, or were you still happy with the way things were going?
It was when we went back on the next time from Harton.
Oh, yeah, all right. So take the story through then.
Well, at Harton we had a spare hut, and we had people used to come in for church services. We had various vicars and Methodist lay preachers and things used to come and ask if they could have a service on a Sunday morning. So I said to the Sergeant Major, I says, "Here, Sergeant Major, how about making the spare hut into a chapel?" I says, "Instead of these lads going to church parades and whatnot on a Sunday morning, they can come in here and have their parade on the site." It was a very peculiar thing in the services, how quickly people cut and done. And, you know, when you went anywhere, if there was a church next to a pub, it was a Roman Catholic church, it was amazing the number of Roman Catholics that you had in your unit that used to want to go to church service on a Sunday morning. If there was a Church of England, then there the old Church of England that wanted to go to church service on a Sunday morning. And, of course, you tumbled to these sort of little guys, and you couldn't stop them from going to church service. All you had to do was to take your fatigue room out, and everybody else could go to church service, you see. And they'd cotton onto this early on in the war, and you had these, on a Sunday morning, you had these people going away, and others left on the site. And of course, the ones on the site used to complain because they had all the fatigues to do. You still had meals to cook and such like for these ones that were at the church service, and it used to cause a bit of bother, you see. So I said to the Sergeant Major, I said, "Let's have our own chapel." So we got this painted. He made a beautiful job. He painted the windows. He actually painted the windows in different colours, painted little angels and things on the windows in the church, and then he painted a crucifix on the wall at the bottom and such like, you see. And we got a table and had we got a cloth, and it was from the WVS when they came down and saw the chapel. We got a cloth from the nice cloth that covered the table. It was a small table in front of the crucifix, you see. So we had a chapel now on the site, so all we'd done was send invitations out to various people to come in and give their service at the chapel for the time we were there. And this solved a lot of problems for us, because it wasn't the same people getting fatigues each day. Because, you see, you still had people in the army too. "I'm not religious and I'm not going to church." So they were the ones that were actually imposed upon you. They were fatigued. They got fatigues. And this solved the problem, because if they wanted the Roman Catholic service, we should just say, "Oh, well, there's no need to go to church. We'll send along, get the father to come along and give a service in the chapel." And the Church of England, we should get the vicar along to come to get a service in the chapel. But it solved the problem for us as far as people, because, you see, Tyne Dock, they didn't have their own church, so they had to go to Shields and such like to go to the churches. They had to go down into Shields. And once they got in there and the church service was over, they were straight to the bar and just get back in time for dinner that the other ones that had stopped and have to prepare for them, you see. Solved that problem for us. They didn't get off the site. But anyway, we got movement orders again. And the reason we got these movement orders was now because the new menace, the V2s. And we were moved back into London area, Hayes Common.
We were moved back. Where was
Hayes
that?
Common. It was South London.
Hayes?
Hayes. South London, out of London, South London, out of the city. And we were moved back to Hayes when the V2s started coming across. And of course there was no answer at the time. All we were moved down for was they knew that we were going to be under the cross-examination when this came. What's happening? How are these things getting through? They got away with the first two or three because they told them the gas mains that had blown up. They said gas mains had blown up under the bombs and things that had been dropped, all the condition of the gas mains. The gas mains were blown up, you see. But people soon cottoned on that there was no such thing as gas mains. And I always remember the first one I ever had contact with. We'd left Hayes and we went to the cinema. And Sydenham, I think it was, where the cinema was, a place called Sydenham. We went to the cinema and coming back, we got onto a bus for the comeback. And about a half a mile up the road, we just suddenly saw this bus in front of us just disappear. And we the driver in our bus stopped the bus and we nipped up. And here is a wreck in a great big hole. Great big hole in the road. And you could double-deck a bus inside of this hole. And we nipped in and the people that were, one or two of them were, had life in them, but the majority were just mangled bodies. And we were getting the bodies out. And it was near a hospital. And one of the lads had rushed across to the hospital and told them that what had happened. But it was useless. It was all corpses, you see, that were there. But people around that had been injured, we were taking them across to this hospital. And then we were told that they were sorry, but they couldn't be treated there. They would have to go to such and such a hospital. It was nearly 2 miles away.
How was that?
The hospital were full up with injury, something that got from some of that area. There'd been others landed, you see, in another area, and they had all the work that they could possibly cope with. So what we'd done was the bus that we were on, we started to put the injured people on the bus we were on and turned it about and sent it straight back to the other hospital, you see. And saw them off at the hospital. Of course, one got back to sight and told them actually what had happened. And we knew what these things were that were coming over. And the guns had only been put around the place, giving the people the impression that we were going to deal with it. Actually, we were. We'd all been sent down and put into certain strategic positions because they'd worked out a net plan. They'd worked out a net plan that for these V2s, they found the GL could pick them up. Because they were so fast and arrived here in such a short time that you couldn't get time to put the guns on after they'd left there. So what they'd done was a grid net plan. All units were notified that they were part of a grid net. Your number so and so on this grid net. And each unit was given a certain number on this grid net. And the whole London area was the grid. Get the idea? Now, all guns would be on a certain location. And the whole grid net was covered, you see. And that if these hadn't been... Your training then went on, waiting for these numbers being sent across, giving you the where you would aim at, giving you the aiming point, you see, and all your guns were immediately put onto the same aiming point. But other guns in the area would be put onto a different aiming point. You see what I mean? The net was covered. We were actually ready for firing to try and stop these V2s from getting through. They had a plan. A lot of people didn't realise this, but we did actually have a plan, and we were told, now, hold your fire. We're not working. Keep your drill going all the time on the grid system. And we were working on this grid system all the time. And we're told that what they were going to do, they'd located where the V2s were coming from, where they were constructed, where they were made and whatnot, and that there was going to be a big air raid on these launching points and where they made them and such like. And if this didn't come off, we were going to go on to grid plan system of trying to bring them down. And that they were pretty certain that we would be able to hit a certain number before they actually got into the area, you see. Although you couldn't aim at them all you could do was fire when you got the word fire. And because of the position of the guns in the grid area, you were nearly sure to hit something. The area was covered. And this grand, great plan was there to be used, and that's the reason that we'd been moved back to London, because of this great plan. And actually, it was never brought into use because they did manage to stop the V2s at the launching sites and also got them at the where they made them. They also got them, so there was no necessity for the grid plan to be brought into operation. But the V2, it was something that we realised then that had never been ever used before. You see, the advance they made was much beyond the advance that we had. The units that we had nothing up to this standard. We had nothing up to this. We had nothing up to the standard of the V1, although the V1 was a useless weapon to send across. It's too easy hit. But the V2s, we realised that the Germans had weapons superior to ours when the V2s were coming over. And we were very, very pleased when we heard that they had been stopped. But during this period, you see, you what they call it, your forces had been gathering, ready for the landings overseas. We had seen all these troop movements and everything, no idea what they were for, and that was maybe another reason why we brought down to London, you see, to cover all the troop movements that were being all brought down to the coast ready for embarkation for the overseas, for the landings, you
That's
see.
That's for D-Day.
That was the day for the D-Day landings.
Now, had you been... why did the Communist Party used to put on quite a lot of pressure for the Second Front once
for
they were...
For the Second... Well, the Second Front, it didn't concern us, you see. We knew what was happening.
But you were quite happy with the way the war was going.
We were quite happy with the way things were going. We were quite happy with the way things were going. I had missed out the part where Dick Ackland, I had met up with Dick Ackland.
Well, let's put that in. When had you met Dick Ackland?
I'd met Dick Ackland when I went up to Scotland.
At Dumbarton?
At Dumbarton. And he was in my unit, actually.
That was in 443 battery.
In 443 battery.
Which was still your unit. But I mean.
That's right.
So what was Dick Ackland like then? Because
he was Lance Bombardier. He was my Lance Bombardier.
And this is the Sir Richard Ackland.
This was the Sir Richard.
What was he like?
He was only a small chap, you know, Dick Ackland. He wasn't a big chap. And he had a peculiar type of voice, actually. But, he was a brain
box. What was funny about
him? He was a brain box. He was funny about him. He had his own typewriter. He had a small typewriter with him. And anything that he wasn't satisfied with, he typed out and immediately sent it to ward office and whatnot. And they cottoned onto this sort of thing. They didn't want the unit, what they call it. They cottoned onto it. And the next thing we knew, that Dick Ackland was being discharged from the unit because he was required at Parliament.
You said he had a funny voice. What was funny about his voice?
Rather squeak in the voice, you know. You could imagine him on a platform with a rather effeminate voice, you know. He hadn't a deep voice at all, Dick Ackland.
Was he friendly?
He was very, very friendly, and he was very political. Now, this is when we used to get on about politics. And we were talking, and I happened to say to him one time, like, oh, your sort of politics don't fit in with mine. He said, what are you? And I said to him, well, I'm a Marxist. I've read Marx and whatnot, and I think that Marx is the real socialism, the real social existence. I says, utopian existence, Marxism. The ultimate end. Marx meant the ultimate end is utopia. And we used to have arguments about this, you know. And he had a very good, he was a reasoning mind. He was very, very good in debate and whatnot. And we used to sit and chat in the tent. Quite a few with political minds used to get together. We had Scots lads and whatnot. We all got together and we discussed certain things. And the things we actually discussed was, this war was the war to end war. Surely to God, after this, there couldn't be another war, you know. This was the war that was going to end wars. But the only way that you could end wars was by bringing all countries together. And this was where the European idea developed from, because APCA were working on this. They'd already started in the units. APCA had started in the units. And we had various lectures that came around, you see.
Could you just explain what APCA was for the tape?
The Army Bureau of Current Affairs. And They weren't only dealing with the war as it stood at present, but they were dealing with what the country were going to do after the war. Because, you see, what we had to realise was that we couldn't go back to the country the same in 19... when the war finished. We couldn't go back to the country that we lived in when the war started. When the war started, we were a pretty rich country. We had a lot of unemployment, but at the same time, we had a lot of employed. When we left, when we went back into Civvy Street, we were going to find a new Civvy Street, an entirely different Civvy Street. And APCA were the people that were putting you right for this, you see, that we were going into a bankrupt country that had to start all over again. And we thought, we discussed various things, and Dick Ackland that actually set me straight onto the idea that we could run into a socialist Britain after the war. He says, you see, he says, we're living in a type of socialism during the war. He said, we have a type of socialism. He says, we haven't a socialism. He says, the state don't do anything. He says, we're in a peculiar fluid position at the present time. And then he pointed out, it was through Dick Ackland that I realised that in Civvy Street during the war we'd still be having strikes and whatnot. There'd still been strikes going on in Civvy Street. Of course, in the services we didn't realise this. We didn't realise that certain people had been going on strike. And I was surprised when he turned around and told me that the miners had been on strike. He says, you would know that the... I said, I didn't know the miners had been... He says, oh yes, the miners were on strike. I says, what were they on strike for? He says, it was one of these things. He says that when people were taken into munitions and such like from Civvy Street, the women were all... it could only be women because the men were all at war, you see. The men were all being trained for war. He says, so the women were brought into jobs. He says, and the miners who had been taken out the services and sent back to the mines and such like, he says, suddenly realised that here were women working in factories and such like, semi-skilled jobs, getting bigger wages than what they were actually making in the mines. He says, and this upset them, you see. He says that they realised then that things weren't right and that they wanted more money. He says, and they actually had a strike. He says, no, he says, he didn't realise till then the situation that had been created, because the mines hadn't been taken over by the government. All they'd done was took a leasehold on them. The owners still owned the mines. The government didn't. The owners would be still being paid the cash that they'd not suffered at all through the war, because they still owned the mines. The government, the state was running the mines through the Department of Energy and whatnot. They were still running the mines, you see. The state were running the mines, but the mines were still owned by the coal owners. And this was the peculiar situation that he explained to me, that when they were on strike during the war, who were you on strike against? Who was going to settle the argument? Was it going to be the state who had taken over the mines, or was it being the coal owners who still owned the mines? And this is what had happened, that the Ministry of Energy had put it on the coal owners to decide on what wages they could afford to pay the miners during the war. They had to give them the increase, because you couldn't have women's land army and such like earning bigger wages than miners who were creating all the energy to make the ammunition and everything that these people were having to make, you see. So they had to increase the miners' wages. It was also through Dick Ackland that I heard that the Rolls-Royce workers had went on strike. The women in Scotland had went on strike in the Rolls-Royce factories because they weren't getting the same wages as the men for doing the same work. And Rolls-Royce had been compelled to pay women during the war the same wages what the men were paid. You see, these were sort of things that you didn't realise, and it was Dick Ackland that brought this out to me. He was following all this sort of thing, which I had no knowledge of.
What did you think of his politics? Because he had slightly unusual politics.
He had unusual politics, but I thought that his plan, as I saw it, was great. He took you through. Philosophy was his chief. He was great on philosophising. And he took you through from government after the war that we started to the European government. And then he actually took you through to world government. And... he told you how this war had occurred through the breakdown of the League of Nations, America leaving the League of Nations and going to this list. He'd explained all this to all these debates it hadn't been through an organised debate. It was through sitting talking to each other in the huts and such like that. You got all this knowledge, you see.
Did you see him as a socialist, if not a Marxist?
Some as a socialist, yes, with his ideas. Some actually as a socialist. That this state ownership, and then through state ownership, if all countries' industry was all state-owned and such like, then there was no reason why the whole of the industries couldn't be worked together through on a European basis and then on a world basis, you see.
But he wasn't a Marxist.
He wasn't a Marxist, no. He wasn't a Marxist. But he actually satisfied me in mind that it was possible. It was possible to get through into a socialist system from the system that the war had brought on.
Without a revolution?
Without a revolution.
So this is where you were... This is a change, because before you'd actually joined the army.
That's right. I thought that the only change... The only way we could work from... to work a control was by revolution. Work a control could only be undertaken by revolution.
So you put it down to Dick Ackland, who...
Well, he was one of the chief people. But I met other people then, later... When I went in Dadka, I got in Dadka myself.
Okay, so Ackland had been with you up in Scotland. Now, so
he changed my approach to. He told me things that happened during the war that I had no knowledge of, because being in the services, we were soldiers, and we were military, and we knew what was happening military wise, but we didn't know what was happening otherwise. You see,
how long was he with you, Ackland?
I think he would be with me for about 6 months.
Up at Dumbarton?
Up at Dumbarton. He'd be with me for about 6 months. But he went back to Parliament. Parliament reassembled. They got Parliament together again. They had a national government, you see. And he was actually in the government. He was in the government, Dick Ackland. I don't know what job he'd done in the government, but he was in the government.
Now, that was a bit of a digression, because just to cover...
Well, there's certain digressions you must have, you see.
Oh, yes. Now, you were down at... At Hayes Common.
That's right.
You'd set up this grid system, but it wasn't used.
It wasn't used. We had worked it out, and after we'd had it explained, and after we'd seen how it worked and whatnot, we were fully convinced, right, we can take on these vetoes. If it's necessary, we can take on these vetoes and we can actually shoot them down. Now, this put new heart into us.
And also, you just mentioned that the D-Day was about
D-Day. Well, the D-Day was about to happen because we'd seen all the troop movements. We could see all the troop movements.
And all this time you were at Hayes Common?
We were at Hayes Common.
So what happened next then?
Well, from Hayes Common, we...
Were you there during D-Day itself?
D-Day, yes. This was... we were there on D-Day.
June the 6th.
We were there D-Day, and we were also there during VA Day.
So you stayed at Hayes Common?
We stayed at Hayes Common.
Right through.
We finished up at Hayes Common, right through.
So you were there from, at least June 44.
That's right.
Over
a year at Hayes Common. And you see, it was through being at this one place for the period of time that we got interested in other things, because... The second front started. We realised that there was going to be an end to the war. And APCA took on certain people to give certain discussions and debates to the units, in the various units, you see. Fortunately, I was selected and I went on a course. I went to Morley College on a course. And they were quite...
Morley College. In Lambeth.
Yes. Went there on a course.
What sort of a course was it then?
They called it the British Way in Purpose. And this was because the APCA were introducing pamphlets, a series of pamphlets. I think there were 12. And they were taking you through, right from when the war ended, the situation that would occur, restoring industry back to civilian use and all this happening there, the employment of men, how we were going to get men into employment. The destruction had destroyed so many houses and whatnot that they were going to have to, the government were going to have to start a complete rehabilitation program for the forces. This is what, not only for the forces, but for civilians also. There was going to have to be a complete rehabilitation program, you see. And they had these pamphlets, and the finest, I wish I had kept mine, they were the greatest pamphlets I'd ever read. And when you read them, it took your mind back to when I read Marx and when I read Engels. Certain things that would come into my mind, I would say, oh, that's what Marx advocated, that's what Engels advocated, you see. And you suddenly realised that there was the possibility of moving through into a socialist society when the war finished. That you would have to have rationing and this, that, and the scarcities created. People would have to get used to hardship and such like after the war, as well as the hat in the war, you see. Hardships had to be adopted after the war.
So this course took you through the 12 pamphlets, did it?
Took you through the 12 pamphlets.
And what were you meant to learn, how to put forward them or how to argue with? I mean, were you allowed to put your own views forward?
You had to know these pamphlets. You had to pass an exam on each pamphlet. On each pamphlet, you had to pass an exam on to say that you could go in. And what happened was you went into discussion groups and you would be picked as the leader of the discussion group. And you had to be able to answer the questions on the pamphlet. There was the 12 pamphlets that you had to study, and just like the time you were on this course. And you didn't know which pamphlet you were going to have to take as leadership, obviously. So you know every pamphlet. But what we done, we were given one pamphlet at a time, and it was illustrated, and you went through it, and you discussed it, until you had all the various points that you wanted to know, you see, and then you went on to the second pamphlet.
Now, were you supposed to put... You were supposed to be neutral, were you?
Oh, yes, yes.
You weren't, neutral. I mean, you were a Marxist.
That's right. But I was neutral as far as this was... All we were doing was putting through. But I realised that this was my idea of socialism, you see, what the pamphlets, to me, were socialist. But they could have been put forward through a socialist society.
So you didn't mind?
I loved it. I thought this is great. This is something that I can get onto a platform and I can really discuss this sort of thing and put forward the projects that they're putting forward. And because you see, nationalisation of the mines and everything were being talked about in the pamphlets. All these things that we had advocated were being talked about through the pamphlets, were being discussed through the pamphlets, you see. And then we sent back the site, and on site, you had to take a pamphlet at a time at a discussion group, hear the opinions of all the people in there, point out where they were wrong, where you thought you were right, where the pamphlet was right, and where what they were putting forward you thought was wrong, couldn't be introduced. And we'd done this with a full of 12 pamphlets, you see. Now, one of the pamphlets, well, the last part, I believe it was a pamphlet 12, I think it was a beverage report. It was one of the pamphlets anyway. And the free health system and the number of people that wouldn't be able to put into employment straight away after the war finished, and how are we going to recompense them? We couldn't just turn them onto a market and say find a job and not compensate them for they had to have money, unemployment benefits. They had to have benefits, certain benefits had to be paid until such a time as the structure, the whole structure of industry and such like, was put back into civilian hands, so we could get employment started again, you see. And this was all discussed, and this was something which I had been on platforms for and such like during strikes and such like, during minor strikes, and during, not only during the strikes, but also during times when you were politically speaking for a political party, you see. And these pamphlets actually stood me in very good stead, because you didn't only take, you see, there was one of the pamphlets was an empire pamphlet. The handing over of India to the Indians, or handing over of Africa to the Africans. And this was all discussed in these pamphlets. It was marvellous. There were a marvellous lot of pamphlets. And the breaking up of the empire, you see, was also a discussion. Well, we had always advocated, the Marxists had always advocated that we shouldn't be exploiting other countries. This was part of the empire. This fitted in beautifully with what I had always been talking about. It did. And actually, it was these pamphlets that, when I came into Sibley Street, really had me in a position where I could support any political party, really. You see, the point was, as long as this was being discussed, it was a national party that we had at the present time, and these were the subjects being put forward by the government or government pamphlets. You see what I mean? These were actually government pamphlets, and we had conservatives, liberals, and Labour and everything. We still had them in the national government, but these pamphlets were being put forward and supported by them. Socialist pamphlets. In the world, it was true socialism. I hope you can get your hands on some sometime, on these British Way, they were termed the British Way and Purpose pamphlet, the way they were put out in booklet form, and you had these 12